Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Germany podcast. I'm Travis Dow. I've been a bit busy lately. My new German podcast about the U.S. culture called Americana für euch is number one and new and noteworthy in history in Germany. And I launched that show. I published the first show 1 month ago as of yesterday. And I launched it on iTunes 3 weeks ago. And yeah, it's just kind of been hanging out in first place the whole time. And it's, if I compare it to History of Alchemy, it has 20 times the downloads in the first month compared to History of Alchemy. So, and it's in German, which is awesome. So, I'm on episode 24 in 1 month. So I'll let that sink in for a second. So there's reason to celebrate. So as you probably know, this show also exists in German. There's always an English and German version. So, and that was kind of an experiment, but the German version of this show isn't even my smallest show anymore. It's just kind of awesome. But now, so speaking of Germans and Germany, let's talk about the Franks. So here we go. It's the Franks that really are the dividing line between the Romans and later medieval Europe. So it's why they don't just get talked about for French history, but the Kingdom of Germany too, or the Holy Roman Empire even. And all of that took shape with and against the Franks. So now, are they German or French? They're German. Sorry, that wasn't really my point. The interesting thing for me is that the Franks as Merovingians are dealt with in podcasts dealing with French history, and there's already a lot out there. So I'm going to emphasize why they're important to Germany, obviously, for this show, and the Franks in general. And coming up, when I get to Charles the Great, I'll publish the episode I did with the Lesser Bonapartes podcast. And just so you know, they also did a mini-series on the Franks. It's a very different format and very different emphasis, because I'm trying to lay the groundworks for the later Kingdom of Germany, and they were kind of going for more from a French perspective. So it's great. So go listen to that as well. And if you want to hear the Charles the Great episode early, then they've already published it, so you can go listen to that there. Where I talk with them and we just talk about Charles the Great, and we talk about things that I won't talk about when I do an episode on him. So it's just awesome. It all fits together. So go over there and listen to that. And there's others. There's others that deal with Charles the Great or the Franks or Merovingians and whatnot. There's a History of France podcast. But like I said, I'm going to take a different spin. So let's get to it. And actually, we've already talked about the Franks a lot. So if it seems like I'm going fast, remember that we talk about them in the Lombard episode, the Frisian episode, we contrast the Frisians with the Franks. Both of those peoples get conquered by the Franks. And even in the Roman miniseries, we talk about the early days of the Franks. And I kept mentioning that this miniseries is coming, and, so here it is. So, who were the Franks? One thing to note, one thing that obviously must be true and is probably important historically, is that at least in their early days and their earliest descriptions of them, as far as, when Romans even met them in battle and that kind of thing, is that the early Franks were tough. They had light hair, mustache, like many Germanic tribes, but with Franks it was noted, and tall, and German, basically, like a lot of the other Germanic tribes. And they're a West Germanic tribe. So now I should probably point that out, because I've been mentioning a lot of East Germanic tribes previously, but they all died out. So then, Frisians are West Germanic, etc. And we have these, so tall, kind of, light-haired, people wearing kind of rugged, like, animal furs, chainmail, at least chainmail later on. But the interesting thing, like, all Germanic tribes at this point, they learned to really fight from the Romans. And they were tough. I mean, the Romans had a hard time beating them, but, you know, eventually they were a federati, which, so we've talked about all that, even in specifically to the, about the Franks. So I'm not going to repeat all that now. But it's the Romans that teach the Franks how to be so good. And all the Germanic tribes, the Vandals, the Goths, they all learn from the Romans. And they all, you know, there's Goths in the Roman army. And we had the same thing with Ariovistus and Theodoric. And all these people had a Roman, Greek, like Byzantine Roman upbringing, or just Roman upbringing. And the Franks were the same. So the Romans taught the Franks how to fight. Why? To fight other Germans, and then also to fight against the Huns. And there were many Franks in the Roman military. So we do have this like continuation of Roman military strategy teaching the Franks, and now the Franks using this to keep on conquering. And they also, like the Romans, had a huge influence on European history. The Franks gave rise to modern France, even gave it their name. And in German, Frankreich, short for Franken, like Frankenreich, the Empire of the Franks. It's still what Germans call it, you know, the Frankish Empire, basically. And it gave rise to Germany itself. And, you know, there was, and the Franks are kind of the grounds, like it's the reason for so many of the Franco-German wars over the centuries, like 1,000 years of warfare between those two countries. You know, they took over an area that was very Roman and yet Celtic genetically. And let me back up for a second because I'm going fast because I've said all this before. In case you haven't heard the relevant History of Germany episodes or it's been a while, I'm going to repeat myself a little, I think. That's probably for the best. But to set up the Franks properly, I need to repeat some stuff that I've at least mentioned before in passing. And one of those things is that I've done a whole mini series now on the Celts to explain who the Gauls were before Roman times. And now, so, you know, if you're just listening here because you like the history of France, then you've still come to the right place. So I talked about the Celts in what is today modern France. And then I talked about Gallo-Roman, you know, French, like basically the Gaelic Romanized, even Roman citizens towards the later part of the empire. So, but it's Gaul that Franks conquer first and really set up as their homeland and you know, even creates the seed for modern-day France as opposed to Roman Gaul. What they invade is still Roman territory. So Gaul was not independent, it was part of the Roman Empire, and it's the Franks that would make it the nation it was in the Middle Ages. Same with Germany. So modern-day France was Gaul in Roman times. Cisalpine Gaul was heavily Romanized and were Roman citizens by the times the Franks really became a problem. And we covered all this before, so this is all repeat. But by the time the Germanic invasions came, they were definitely Roman. We've called them on the show before. We called them Gallo-Roman. That's just how you can refer to them. They built Roman cities, wrote Latin, were instrumental in the history of Christianity in many ways, and even spreading it past the Roman borders. So, again, I've said all this before. There were Gallo-Roman emperors. So these genetically Celtic people were as Roman as any Italian by the late empire, absolutely. And so it's these guys that the Franks invade. That's my point. Franks were Germanic, not Latin, but the Gauls were genetically not Latin either. They were, and if there's one thing I've been trying to show is that the line between Celts and Germanic, though definitely different Indo-European language branches, were genetically very blurry at the borders, which is why I did a whole mini-series on the Celts, because, you know, they're the peoples, like if in Bavaria and southern Germany, you heard Celtic languages for thousands of years, not Germanic languages. That's why I covered them. So that's my point. I'm trying to show that at the time of the Germanic invasions, there was not much of a distinction or at least very blurry lines between Gallic and Roman and even like Italian and Roman. That was just a totally different thing than the early days. Like when I was talking about the Bronze Age Celts, totally different now, hundreds of years different, only genetically Celtic. And now it's the Byzantine Greeks that call themselves Roman. So the Roman Empire still existed for another 1,000 years in the East, but in the West, we call them the Byzantines or the Byzantine Empire. So they don't die out, but the Western Empire kind of starts dying out in Frankish times, which I all covered. That's kind of where we left off with the Roman miniseries, and that's kind of where we're going to keep going today. So when these Germanic Franks did take over, they just saw themselves as the next group to call themselves Roman, really, especially at first. And this was actually true at first. If you go back and listen to the episode on the Federati, they were inheriting the local government rule from the church mostly now, which is kind of interesting. But they still used Roman titles and all that. I'll explain this in much more detail with specific examples as we go. But also remember, we already talked about this. So we mentioned the Franks on the episode with Jamie Redfern. That's the great one to listen to. Jamie Redfern came on as a guest, and I talked about this part of Frankish history a lot on the Roman miniseries again and again. So yeah, anyways. But what's important to remember is the relationship between the Frankish king and the Pope in Rome. That becomes crucial. That sets a precedence for all time in the Holy Roman Empire, for example. So this relationship is one thing that I wanted you to take out of all the previous episodes, and we need that knowledge now. The Frankish king and the Pope in Rome. And it's the Franks that would lay the groundwork for this relationship, and it's the Saxons that would continue it, and then it really becomes embedded, because it's outside of one dynasty. That's the German way. That's how the Kingdom of Germany works. It works with the Pope's blessing. So the Roman idea of empire, for example, with permission from Rome, gives rise to the Frankish Empire instead of just a kingdom, and the Holy Roman Empire instead of just Kingdom of Germany. And later even, you know, we continue with the Austrian Empire, really. The precedence is set again with the Frankish now. And other Eastern European empires, like the Russian Empire, inherit their right as Emperor Tsar, in this case instead of Kaiser, but the word comes from Caesar. Both Kaiser and Tsar come from Caesar. The Russians see themselves as a continuation of Rome too, but this time inheriting through Byzantium, because Byzantium thought, okay, Rome is dead in the West, we're the real Romans now. And the Russian Tsars would make the exact same claim that the German Holy Roman Emperors would. Like, just identical. Just the same reasoning, same logic, just different, you know, different times and at different places. And in the East, of course, instead of, you know, now the Franks were famously the protector of the church for the Roman Catholic Church. So that's what the Russians did, the same thing for the Eastern Orthodox Church. That's basically it. And of course, there's a Greek Orthodox and Romanian and Byzantine and all that. The Russians really consider themselves as inheriting this tradition and being the protector of the Orthodox Church. But for the West, it is the Franks that would really redefine what it means to be an emperor for the medieval period. And medieval empires are based off of this Frankish definition of Roman imperator. And the first name I'm going to throw out there is Clovis, and he's been covered on other podcasts, and I'll come back to him next episode, I promise. Gregory of Tours writes of Clovis, and so Clovis, the thing that I want you to remember now on this episode, on this introductory episode to the Franks, is that Clovis was Salian. And the Salian Franks, the Salians, you could just call them, started in the Hercynian Forest, where the Sala flows into the Main. And we will start there. Anything before that gets really, really murky. We've covered it before. And in any case, when we talk about Franks, there's no point in going before Clovis the First, because Clovis the First had to beat up other Frankish tribes first. And he had to do that anyways. And before he could get to non-Frankish Germanic tribes. And then Gauls and Gallo-Romans. So after Clovis the First, when you start talking about the Merovingians, you're talking about the Franks, and you mean all Franks, because Clovis was a Salian Franks, and there were other different Frankish dukes, etc., all set up, but Clovis really takes over, unites the Franks under the Salian kind of dynasty. In German history, they say, you know, there's the Salia, the dynasty, and then there's the Saxons, and then there's others, and then, you know, they differentiate between these first Salian Franks and later Frankish, because there's so many Frankish dynasties all over Europe, after Charles the Great, for sure, but even sooner, but after Charles the Great, all of Europe has Frankish Salian blood in their royal family. All of them. including, you know, England, all of them, Spain, every single one. To this day, even Charles the Great is one of the descendants of every single royal family in Europe, including Russian. I mean, you know, Russia died out, but even including the Russian czars and all that. Anyways, my point is that after this, it all becomes very simple, because when you say Clovis, you mean Merovingians, you mean Franks. It just gets much simpler. So Salian equals all this right now. As the Saxons claimed to descend from Macedonians, so the Franks claimed to be from Troy. And by the way, where does the term Frank come from? So that's not really clear. It could mean the, like, a point from a spear or a spear point. It could also mean free, like free man. But that's not very likely, I think. I don't remember why I wrote that down, but honestly, no one really knows. And it's a waste of time to go through all the theories. It doesn't matter. But what I did mention before is that they were a major thorn in Rome's side for centuries. And we've mentioned some of their incursions in earlier episodes. Magnentius was Frank, like Roman. Silvanius was emperor in Cologne for 33 days and 355, Frank. Arrogast. So these are like really old Franks that still played a role in the Roman world. And I have to, again, for like the fourth time, just mention the year 406. On New Year's Eve 406, this romantic notion of all these Germanic tribes flooding over the frozen Rhine, and it was just a horrible day to be Roman, but a very romantic one if you study German history. And the Franks were among these, and it was the Franks that over the next couple centuries, really, or century and a half, start to really come out on top of all of these that are now in Belgium and France and that kind of thing. So much so that we mentioned in the previous episode that other ones died out. Franks were just too damn German to do that. They just, you know, they changed all of those around them instead of the other way around. But in those days, we had, you know, Goths defending Gaul, basically. So it was, you know, Romans. To say they were fighting Romans was a stretch. It was Western Germanic tribe, the Franks, fighting in Eastern Germanic tribes, the Goths and Vandals, etc., who had gotten to France first. So, to say they were invading the Roman Empire, while factually accurate, doesn't really paint a good picture, but the Franks settle the area around northern France, I know that area, and have sort of, you know, create this structured government. They start to emulate the Romans. They rule wisely for generations, and so we see, like, Salic law. That's the Salian law in Belgium. And Belgium becomes very important for the Franks. That becomes their homeland. But there are other parts of Germany today still called Franken, like Nassau, Hesse, Unterfranken, Oberfranken. That's kind of the core region where the old Franks came from, or at least where they reconquered against the Saxons later. So over the Franks, over the centuries, at some point we differentiate between the ones that stayed put in Thuringia, in Thuringia, like the Thuringian Franks. Though that's Franken, that's to, like, today there's a Franken in Bavaria. It's a region of Bavaria. But they're not Bavarians. Trust me, they're Franks, and they'll let you know. But those are very different than the Franks that streamed across Gaul. That's what I'm saying. And we get a man named Clodion, who's maybe Merovig's dad. And Merovig, I'll get to in a second, but we do now definitely, these are Salian Franks I'm talking about. And out of this group of Franks, well, now we can just call them Merovingians after Merovig. But those two are just so murky and hard to find sources on. 451, we have, you know, the Huns and Attila, and the Romans need help. We have the Battle of Chalons. I think I mentioned all this before. But Merovig died in 457 or 458. And we have Childeric, Merovig's son. And if I'm moving really fast, that's because on this part, go listen to Lesser Bonapartes if you want to hear more. They talk about some of this. The point is, it's just so murky. There's not a whole lot I can say for certain about this, and I want to keep moving. But we do have the start of the Merovingian dynasty. That's why I even bring up these murky characters. They are the fathers of the Merovingian dynasty. And now don't get that confused. It's not the Carolingian. So after them, this comes the Carolingians with Charles the Great, etc. So it's the corrupt kind of sedated Merovingians that it's the Carolinians that take over. So this is before that. But this is way before that, where the Merovingians make a name for themselves first. It's not their declining days yet. They got to go out of conquering, and that they do. So way before Charles I, we have Clovis I, and Clovis is the one, and Gregory of Tours, again, does a great history and is kind of the primary source here. One little side note is another one of my sources, and this I watched this documentary in German just to kind of get a feel for how do Germans look at Childeric. And in this documentary, he had blonde, kind of a brony tail, you know what I mean? Like where the side of the head is back is all shaved, and then the top is, and I was like, ah, oh, that is weird. That is not how I would imagine a tough Germanic Frank with this little dinky ponytail and just kind of walking around. Ah, oh, just weird. Like walking around like a frat boy carrying a sword, basically. I don't even know how to say brony tail in German, so I'm not sure how to translate this concept, or even frat boy. Like, they don't even know. But it was a German documentary, so I'll let it slide. Maybe it was historically accurate. A lot of Germanic tribes maybe did shave parts of their head, and to the Romans looked very different, and they also had, yeah, so maybe, I don't know. But in this documentary, all these Franks are running around with the same haircut. And it's all this, so in this TV show, they all have their hair up in these really high up ponytails with the rest of their head shaved below. So Childeric, that's Clovis's dad, by the blonde guy with the brony tail, Clovis's dad. He dies. Clovis was only 16 when he died. And what I found was more interesting was that centuries later, the tomb of Childeric was found. And yet, so the arms, like the Roman coins, gold ring stuff, other stuff, maybe Basina's stuff, these were all given to the then monarch of France at the time of the find. And who was that monarch who ruled at the time? It was the Sun King himself, Louis XIV. So they made it through the French Revolution, and you can still go look at Childeric and Basina's stuff. But the Sun King took all these, you know, kind of artifacts and made them heirlooms and kind of, use these as almost as relics, saying, now look, this is like the very first French king kind of thing. Like we now, this is how good our roots go back this far. And that's just, you know, a great sense of pride for a royal family. And Louis XIV probably was not related to Childeric, although oddly enough, you know, through enough odds and corners, Carolinians were definitely related to Merovingians, and Louis XIV was absolutely related to Charlemagne. Every monarch was in the centuries after him. So that means that, yeah, I mean, this was an distant ancestor of Louis XIV, you know, through distant cousins and that kind of thing. Not like father-son, that's not what I mean, but related, yes. So you can still go see that stuff today. That was maybe the most interesting thing for me about Childeric, is that it survived and it was important in later French history. And yeah, it's kind of neat. So definitely the French definitely see the Merovingians and the Franks as their predecessors. Sorry, as the Kingdom of France, just as the Kingdom of Germany did too. So that was just really interesting to me, that a French king would just be like, yeah, this Frankish. And remember, so Franks definitely had spoke a Germanic language, not like French, which is much more Latinized. So yeah, really interesting. The seed was planted for Gaul to become France, basically, with the Merovingians. And in the last episode, we saw the Germanic tribes that died out. So Franks are just doing fine to this day, really. So what made them different? And this is what will differentiate this introductory episode from the rest, is right now I want to give you a splash of, like, culture and a feeling for what they were like before I go through the king-to-king and battle-to-battle kind of thing. So we already did that before with other Germanic tribes, but the Franks are interesting because I kind of saved them for last in that regard, because they were just culturally, like, if you were talking to a Frank, they must have just been so obviously Frankish, like this Germanic, with mustache and long hair, maybe brony tail, I don't know. But they influenced those around them. They also, you know, Latinized their language and openly and obsessively imitated Roman customs and law, but they also bent it and made them their own. That's the difference between medieval France and, you know, Roman Gaul. Really? Yeah, that's the very definition. So they're interesting because they had this early relationship with Rome. Rome, like many other tribes, but in the migration period, Rome allied themselves with Franks against the others, against the Vandals and Goths and that kind of thing. So Franks really stood out and stuck around and had Roman blessing more than they were their Roman enemies. Even if many of them moved, they had a Frankish, like a very strong Frankish identity, already very proud of their past battles and, you know, went a conquering through Gaul as just, you know, we're taking our land right, we're taking our Frederati back kind of thing. And once they got to France, they were very stationary. They were just the latest people to come in, but they were the last, I would say. Germans kept trying, English kept trying, but it was the Franks that really made France, France. That's where we get the name. It's the very definition. So, and we see them writing down their Germanic laws early in areas that are today around Belgium. So that's another core area for the Franks. And it was already like centuries of bodies of work, this Frankish law, when it came time to really be Salic law and under Clovis and formalized. And some of the areas to mention are like Batavia, Brabant, Hainaut, I already mentioned, Flanders. These were the Frankish areas before the invasion of Clodonion in 447. And Franks, the Frank noblemen, were kind of known as the Leudes, or Leudes, maybe. I'm trying to pronounce it correctly, but I'm not sure how to... Yeah, the Lesser Bonaparte just said Leudes, I think. So these are men of religion and council, quote unquote. Like these were the earliest form of their nobilities was, again, don't think Druid, that's Celtic. They all died out. Romans like genocided them away. So, but these Leudes would get together, and in German, then you also have this council, which like Rat. So you have a Rat is very a famous word in this kind of hierarchy. And we talked about that in the Frisian episode, for instance. But so the Franks had their Leudes, and that became more and more formalized nobility. And after Clovis, we get the Salic law. It becomes Frankish law after Clovis. He just says it's the law of all the Franks now. And this eventually morphs into Merovingian law, which, you know, then we get, I mean, Charles the Great, I don't want to jump ahead yet, but Charles the Great does another great reform and all that stuff, but these start to get written down. And based on this Frankish law, I should emphasize this one, because I've already mentioned Lex Burgundonium, Frisorunium, or whatever. Those are all modeled on Frankish law. So this is really the first. This is the codified one that all the others are being influenced by. And the earliest ones are 5th century. The extant copies that we have are 5th century. And these laws, just to give you some more examples, I've already mentioned some throughout the episodes, but they cover acts like crimes against individuals, along with punishments, and then alternatives which the community may allow instead of the punishment, which takes us to the term, and I've been waiting for this one forever and ever on the show, ladies and gentlemen, Wehrgeld. And Wehr in this, so it's like money against a person. You know the term werewolf? Like that means man-wolf. So in that old Germanic Wehr, and Wehr also still means who, you know, and the question, like who? So Wehrgeld is money, you know, that you, in repayment against bodily harm or, you know, against a crime against an individual. And it's a very well-known aspect of Germanic law. So if you're listening to the show, I expect you to understand this too. This is totally different from later imprisonment type laws and that kind of thing. And at its base, it's the idea of money being paid for redemption of a crime. And German law, just like German law today, kind of, basically, has two sides. It's the crime against the person, okay, but also the crime against the community as a whole. And I would say this still exists in modern German law, this concept definitely exists. It's not just how was the victim harmed, but how was the community harmed? And in old law, it was how can we heal the community? Now it's like, yeah, the lawyers and the state get their piece too, and are also represented as an entity. There's the victim, there's the perpetrator, and then there's also the state, who you have to look out for the state, which doesn't really, it definitely doesn't exist like that in the U.S. So vindication was the norm, very much in contrast to Roman law. So vindication of the individual could be a defense for a smaller community, a way for a leader to save face, just one example. This Wehrgeld had a scale based on the nature of the crime and also on the status of the injured person. And that's super important. So it was a class system in a way. This punishment worked in a class system. If you hurt a nobleman, it was much worse than hurting a slave. And slaves existed. I'll get back to that. So Freidom, or peacemaking money, which sounds a lot like freedom, was a sort of fee you'd pay the state. So you'd literally pay the state freedom. Sounds weird, but that's where all those terms come from. So a judge would then finalize the deal and sometimes could also double or triple the Wehrgeld fine. Like in the last minute, he could be like, okay, not only is he guilty, but I'm also going to, I think he can afford, the triple fine basically. And so the judge could do this. And so then he would just, then the judge, I don't know if he actually had a gavel, but I imagine then he does what do you see a judge doing today? But if you're a nobleman, like Aloydus in Clovis's time, later Merovingians had noblemen as criniti, or people that were used to or allowed to wear their hair long, kind of. That's where that came from. So they had the right to wear their hair, the hair long. So hippie noblemen, I guess, maybe even mullets. But after the long-haired guys, it was the Antrustions, or Leti, Lite, also. These had a higher Wehrgeld associated with them, is my point, if they were the victim of a crime, for instance. And the lowest were the slaves, and I'll get back to that in a second. But in that case, it depended on the worth in the eyes of their owner. So it was still a scale, always, even among slaves. And Wehrgeld did not apply to crimes against kings or public crimes. Then it was, the death penalty absolutely existed. And I would say in those cases, that's what you got. But there was stockades, and again, it was Frankish law that kind of influenced medieval law in many areas. So, but we'll get back. I don't want to jump ahead that far yet. So then there's also the Urteil, which is just a German word for judgment, really. Today in the modern German, in the modern German word, it would say verdict. It could also mean like sentence, like the sentencing. It's the Urteil. To judge someone is Urteil. Jemanden urteilen, to use it as a verb, it's like that's judging someone. So, but in the old Frankish sense, it meant the ordeal. Kind of, it makes me think of the Amish. I wouldn't exactly call it a trial in the modern sense, but it was an ordeal. So it would include an appeal to the deity, so there was a religious aspect, especially if there was no witnesses. And this is so important. Hold on, just pay super attention for a minute. In the oldest sense, God would be the judge of this, okay? Ding, ding, ding. And the church was fine with this aspect of Frankish law and sanctioned it, which leads us to ordeal by boiling water. A priest blesses water, making it holy water, and a stone hung from a cord would be submersed three times, each time deeper in the water, and the person had to drag out the stone or ring, okay? And his arm would be bandaged for 3 days. And remember, boiling water, okay? Now, if it didn't heal his arm or the hand, then he was guilty. Now, there's another thing called ordeal by cold water, which was now this survived as a test for witchcraft. That's why I wanted you to pay attention. So this old, this comes all the way back with the Inquisition used to do and all that horrible medieval stuff. It kind of got bastardized from this really old Frankish thing. And so if there was no witnesses, how do you know if someone's guilty or innocent? Well, you let God judge. and the church allowed it and took this over from the Franks, not the other way around. Roman law did not have any of this. No. Or, I don't want to make absolute statements like that, but not in this sense, not the way the Franks did it. So ordeal by cold water, that's Frankish and Salic law. Like Monty Python's think, you know, witches float, that is actually in Frankish law as a way to determine innocence when there were no witnesses. Yep, that's where that came from. That's not fictional in Monty Python. That's Frankish law. And the arms were tied to his leg. So think, yeah, you know, and kind of like hog tied. And if he floated, he was guilty. So if he floated, he was guilty, right? If he sank, he was drowned. So I guess if he sank, hopefully someone jumped in and fished him out in time. And they didn't know mouth to mouth or CPR back then. So yeah, it's pretty rough. Like even the trial was like, oh, he sank and died. So yay, he was innocent. Wow. Anyways, then there was also ordeal of the cross, where basically two people accusing each other would hold out their arms. And okay, this is like a stamina or a endurance contest, really. So the first to drop their arms loses. And yeah, so imagine if something really serious depended on that. And it's just so ordeal of the cross. It's seriously, who has longer endurance? If I were a Frank, I would just be practicing that all the time, just holding my arms straight out, and I would just be getting those muscles toned. So if I got to complain about somebody else, I can hold my arms up longer. Seriously. I mean, I think I would do that. Then there's hold a heated bar in your hand or walk barefoot over hot iron bars or plates. Then there's a straight up ordeal by fire, which is, you know, walk with a consecrated host in your hands between two fires. And if you're innocent, the cracker will keep you from burning. All right. And in really tricky cases, you flip open the Bible to a random page and read the first sentence, like basically as an oracle. And then there's also ordeal by single combat. And by the way, I hope that Bible one is meant to give you a judgment. That one sounds tricky to me. But okay, so ordeal by single combat. You lose a hand. The defeated combatant would lose a hand, sometimes buried alive. That's the outcome of single combat. It wouldn't always be that they die in the fight, like it was a fight to the death. Because then you make them a murderer, you know, so it's two people accusing each other. Why would you make them a murderer? You make one of them a murderer. No, you fight until one of them surrenders and then the loser loses a hand or is walled up alive. But then that's a, you know, judge community decision, not one person. Anyways, so, this one, the single combat and the ordeal by cold water lasted the longest. Charlemagne, for example, banned the ordeal by cross. So me practicing holding up my arms would only work for, until Charlemagne's time. Okay, so slavery. Slavery was on the books. Merovingian slavery and how a master may liberate his slave. All that was on the books. But moving from laws to slavery, let's get a glimpse of what that actually meant. To the Franks. So slaves were not what we'd call slaves in the modern term, not at all like chattel slavery in the southern United States, for instance. A slave would live in their own house. It'd be more like an indentured servant. They worked for their master sometime, and the rest of the time they worked the land for themselves. And they just had it a bit tougher than a freedman, basically. It was rare for a slave to be beaten. So, I mean, that would be punishable. They weren't slaves in the Roman sense even. So you couldn't just go send them off to be gladiators. Franks didn't have that. Franks did not have that kind of power. Serfdom definitely wasn't like a farmer employee kind of thing. In times of famine, they were always hit the worst. So they were kind of serfs, and France has a long history of serfdom. And let's move on, because we'll get back to this many, many, many times. But I'll stop with this, okay, for right here, with the introduction to Franks, and I'll continue with all of this next time. But there's just a lot to cover. So I've already covered the earliest parts in previous episodes. So if that's what you're here for, go back and listen to some of the episodes on the 406, the invasion of 406, and the Frisians and the Longobards and all those people, because I'm going to mention them being conquered very quickly in future episodes, because I already mentioned all those guys before. That's what all that setup was for. Now it's going to be fast. Dense, fast, Frankish stuff. And this is part one of the Franks miniseries. So then we get to the Saxon ones. Those are already written, ready to go. So buckle down. Here we go. The History of Germany podcast is a member of the Agora Podcast Network. And the podcast of the month is David Crowther's History of England podcast. Great show. Go listen to that. I think Bohemian even did a guest episode for David once. And if you do speak German, go check out my new Americana für euch episode. Follow me on Twitter at Americana Pod. Besides my usual at Podcastnik, where I tweet in English, and I retweet all that stuff. Yeah, it's all connected. But if you want to improve your German, go follow my German Twitter account. That's my first only German Twitter account. And I got to mention, absolutely, on podcastnik.com, or go directly to bohemican.com. A lot of new content out for the Bohemican podcast that Pete and I have been working on. And Pete's been working for months now to get videos out for the YouTube channel. And that's all on Bohemican or on Podcastnik. But also, you can just go to the Bohemican YouTube channel directly. And if you haven't seen our video on the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Pilsen, you absolutely should. We show up there, and we get a lot out of that trip. We went there for 2 days, and we talked to General Patton's granddaughter. We got that on camera. It's a short little 10-minute, but Pete went all out. I wore my grandfather's uniform. Pete went all out in the editing. It took him like 9 months to edit this little 10-minute, 15, 20-minute, whatever it is, video together. It's amazing. It's documentary quality, seriously. Go watch that. That has to do with German history for sure. I even speak German at one part where my grandfather probably rolled over in his grave because I was wearing his uniform. Anyways, so definitely go check out bohemican.com and the Bohemican YouTube channel. And my editor, Mr. Pancake, his real name is Mr. Pfannkuchen, is off in Germany shamelessly on a 2-week trip. So then they should be coming out pretty quick, like maybe weekly or so. Oh, and thanks a lot to those. I know I have seen a couple more reviews on iTunes. Thank you so much for that. And, as always, thank you for listening. Franken mit Schnurrbärte. There you go.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.